you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
It's February 2021, and this is Spin the Rally Pod. I'm rally fan Lisa Rose Sullivan, and we have the experts on hand as ever. Dirtfish senior staff writer David Evans, voice of rally Colin Clark, and former team boss George Donaldson. So, boys, we have one event under our belts. The Monte Carlo Rally has been completed. A record-breaking victory for Sebastian Ogier. An interesting one-event ban suspended for Oit Tanak. But the question that some people have been asking, which we're going to come to at length, should the Monte Carlo Rally have taken place at all? There's been so much negativity in some of the media I've been reading about the fact that the event's taken place at all.
Who wants to start?
Yeah, I found it a little odd, I'd have to say. You're certainly, during the weekend, for me it was a Monte Carlo Rally. It had all the ingredients of a Monte Carlo Rally. I didn't see anything to complain about, if I'm being absolutely honest. You know, the organisers did an incredible job. All the teams did well to get their personnel there. And they put on a great show, and that's what it was. And, you know, in these difficult times, any kind of show is a show that we're all going to enjoy and appreciate. And I, you know, I read that criticism from certain aspects of the media, and I scratched my head, and I went, you know, what's it all about? And I, you know, to be totally honest with you, I couldn't get to the bottom of it. I really couldn't fathom it. I didn't buy any of the arguments in the negative articles that I read, because for me, it was just really positive all the way through for the Monte Carlo Rally. I don't know about you, David. You and I didn't
first of all,
go
Cole,
this time.
Should we list what some of those criticisms were? Well, one, that it wasn't long enough. There weren't enough kilometres or weren't enough stages. One that seems a little silly, there weren't enough fans, there weren't any fans on the stages, and there was sort of complaints about the fact that the curfew was in place in France, yeah. All stuff that was a little unavoidable.
Yeah, totally, totally unavoidable. You know, we'd all have liked to have gone to, if you like, a traditional Monte Carlo rally, but, you know, the fact there was a rally in, you know, under these circumstances, for to me, it should have been, you know, it was an occasion to say, yeah, job done, and job very well done. To the organisers, to the FIA, to the promoter, to the teams, to all the participants. And it left a wee bit of a sour taste to me, certainly, David. I don't know about you.
I can totally see that perspective, Cole. And I agree wholeheartedly with what you've said there. I think the one thing that, one of the issues was the curfew. And if there was an aspect, apart from the fact that we were recording our stuff in Brackley, which definitely didn't feel like a Monte Carlo. The one aspect was the afternoon, wasn't it? That, you know, we were finished by sort of one. We had an hour's difference. Obviously, we were an hour earlier in the UK, but we were finished by 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That was odd. And I can see that's it is quite a strange one, but it was that curfew that essentially allowed us to have a Monte Carlo rally. So, yeah. You know, I've read exactly the same pieces as you. And I've got to be honest, my feeling is the same. I think it was, you can't say it was groundless because it had grounds, you know, in the curfew and the lack of fans and all of that. But this is the modern world right now. This is the world we're living in. So, you know, you've got to deal with it or, you know.
Not groundless, but it seemed a long way away from reality to me, you know, and it seemed a long way from, you know, understanding and appreciating the circumstances that we're all having to endure just now. So, yeah, you're right, not groundless, but a lack of understanding or a lack of appreciation or a lack of...
I would agree with that.
Reality.
You know, I would agree with that. And you know, the discussion about, you know, 250-odd kilometres or whatever, that's the way that some of these events are running now. We're seeing these shorter-form events. You know, look, we're looking towards the Arctic Rally, and that's, you know, what is it, around 260 or something kilometres? I can't remember exactly. Even... something like Sardinia, you know, which is running to a full route. We've seen the route for that coming out this week. It's 305 kilometres. You know, it's all very well for people to bang on about ninth and mid-80s when we had 62,000 kilometres of stages, and I'm as bad as anybody for doing that. But, you know, this is the way that we are right now. We cannot continue to kind of... It's not really fair to compare, even though I compare all the time. I'm a little bit talking myself into a hole here, Lisa. This would be a good time.
I can get you out, David.
Thanks, George.
My turn.
Somebody take the shovel and stop me from digging.
Well, stop you digging. So I'll dig instead of David. So, yeah, look, it was a short rally. I didn't notice it. I was spectating via the app. You know, via I'm registered on WRC.com. I'm look, out of us all here, I'm as big a traditionalist as any of us. And I love the old big rallies that drove all the way around France, the Ardèche, into the High Alps, down into the Mid Alps, and then down to the coastal, you know, the Alpe Maritime. I loved it, and it was an amazing adventure. It's gone. It's history at the moment. Whether it ever comes back, I have no idea. Probably not. But, you know, rallying moves with the times, and it changes, and it survives in the environment that exists. And that's very much the case this year with COVID. And just, you know, 110% applause to the organisers. And I think the promoter. I'm reluctant to give the promoter too much credit ever, because they're not necessarily in it for the same motivation that I follow rallying. But I respect it 100%. I love the product they're giving me, so I really can't complain. But 100% to them all for getting it together and getting us an event out there. It kept me in the house over the weekend, so job achieved for the, and you know, all those multitude of Italian and French and German, Polish, Czech fans that visit Monte Carlo every year in their tens of thousands, even still one of the most popular events in the calendar, spectator-wise, they were all at home watching their TVs, following it on their app, all staying inside and self-isolating. So from the point of view of sending a couple of hundred people down to into Monte Carlo, and what we could see visually looked like a very well-quarantined event, nobody around. All, I'm sure, strictly controlled with COVID tests and bubbles being maintained. Everything I saw looked really disciplined and responsible. I did question it beforehand, thinking that this can't be a good idea. You know, we'll get a caning from the public. You know, people are going to complain. We didn't seem to get a caning from the public. We got a caning from traditionalists about traditionalist issues. Nothing to do with COVID or the reality of a shorter event. Hey, and I understand that. I mean, I know I can sympathise with a lot of the people that I read complaining about the event, that it's lost some of its social niceties. And you know, I loved going up into the Ardèche. Colin, you and I, we are Cafe Central, finding the interesting places. We loved it. Yeah. And yes, we bemoan it's going, but we're not melancholy about it. We get on and enjoy the currency of rallying and the fantastic competitions. These drivers, they're driving on the absolute... Yeah. Dogged edge. It's fabulous to watch. And look, we've got our own young Elfin Evans, who, you know, I mean, I remember you and I being asked along quite early in his career to help him, you know, be more relaxed with journalists. I was pretending to be a journalist at the moment, at that time. So were you.
Yeah,
I'm not pretending to be a journalist anymore. But anyway, but you know what I mean? You know, it's so nice to see that. And then, you know, Seb Ogier, you know, he quite often says slightly outrageous and very strong comments, you know, but he is rallying's biggest fan. He's, you know, he's a big fanboy, loves his sport, he's so passionate about it. But what an incredible mature performance. And I love the fact that he, you know, he dominated it in the way he did performance wise. He could pull out that extra because he's got the experience and he still has the focus and the determination. But isn't it great to see some of the younger drivers coming through as well?
But just, you know, one of the points to pick up on there, you know, undoubtedly it was a shorter event. It didn't have as many stages. You know, Saturday was
still
three
fabulous.
Stages. It didn't matter. Once those stages were up and running, you know, the second stage on Friday when those conditions were evolving and Neville was like 12 seconds quicker than Pierre-Louis Loubet, you know, what was going on? It was
brilliant
Monte Carlo.
Yeah,
you know,
it was great.
And the combination of tyre choices, trying to second guess them, what was Hyundai thinking of taking, you know, a part worn tire. It had everything.
Okay. Had everything.
It was in a more compact form, but for goodness sake, you know, I would far rather have spent my weekend at BGM Sport with Colin than doing anything else. It was super.
And can I bring in about tyres? And George,
while you're just there, can we just talk about tyres? Because of course, big problems for Oit Tanak, and he's picked up this what he thinks is he's told Dirtfish. Was he talking to you, David, or Colin? Who did he give the comments to?
Yeah, it was to me. I spoke to him last week. Yeah.
So he's picked up this one event ban, suspended for, you know, hobbling in on three wheels, which obviously is against the rules and regulations. But I feel it's kind of harsh. Am I wrong for thinking that?
No, it's not. It's not. You are wrong. It isn't harsh. You know, everyone knows what the rule is. Everyone knows what the consequences are. I remember, goodness me, in Germany 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more than that, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he was a young Spanish driver, came into the stage end, two punctures, one spare tyre, rubber completely off, and he's at the end of the stage. We'd come out of the stage, he was in the juniors at the time, and he's debating what to do. And I was with Julian Porter at the time, and we both looked at each other and looked at him and said, well, you've got no choice. You know, you have to park up, super rally, come back tomorrow. And he's going, no, but I can get back to service. And it's like, you go back to service and you will be excluded. You won't get back for super rally.
That's great, Cole. Actually, you've taken a legal and perhaps a moral high ground there. But you tell me, get to the end of a stage and you stand in front of Oit Tanak's cart and say, you're not moving. Because, you know, it harks is immediately back to that conversation, which happened before the rule change for coming in with rubber on the wheels, to Marcus Grönholm. The policeman pulled him over in Wales and said, you can't go. And Grönholm said, I can drive. And he said, no, you can't.
I'm sorry, Cole. You will not ever
stop a driver giving it a go.
Ever. Yes, you will, because I've seen it many times.
You will now, because there is a precedent.
Right, but that is such a black and white rule, David. Where was Oit Tanak? Where was Oit Tanak when his team needed him in the power stage? No, where was he?
Well, he retired. Of course he had.
Right. But not of course he had. He didn't need to retire. He could have been there. Oh, I know it was Saturday, wasn't it?
No, he couldn't. He had to retire.
But the point
ordinarily, you're quite right. But equally, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people about this, and the feeling is, you know, the wording of the steward's decision was quite precise in that, you know, it's not to set a precedent, but that's essentially not to set a precedent for stewards on other events. You know, they don't need to feel duty-bound to follow that ruling. But for me, you're dead right, Cole. It is black and white. You know, you cannot drive without freely rotating, fully inflated rubber on the four corners of the car. You can't. And to me, there's an element that the onus has to be on the driver. You know, but, you know, talking to drivers about this, I've put to them, you know, what happens in the worst case scenario if a dog runs out, you swerve, you lose control of the car, you go up the pavement, you kill two people walking along the pavement. And the feeling is that they're not driving in a dangerous manner. They're driving within the control of the car. And that's the trouble, isn't it? You know, drivers always at this sort of super professional level, they feel that they are in control of absolutely everything. And, you know, I would say 99.9%, if that scenario played out, Oit Tanak would have controlled the car and brought it to a standstill without any
issue. Yeah, but that's not the point.
No, but that's the driver's mindset, Cole. That's where they are.
No, but it's not every driver's mindset, David.
So tell me which driver would have come out of there and just parked up. Of the current manufacturer drivers, who would have just not thought, I'll give it a crack?
But I agree with you. Now that you've reminded me that it was the Saturday and there's no super rally on the Saturday, there was no point in him parking up and staying at the end of the stage.
He had to give it a go.
He had to give it a go. But, you know, under normal circumstances, had there been a super rally option,
he would have been excluded.
Tremendously foolish thing to have done. Tremendously foolish. You know, he took a chance. He thought, well, I'll take my chance with the stewards. I'll take my chance. Maybe I'll manage to sneak in. Maybe, you know, the millions of people that have been watching me on telly, maybe they didn't really notice that I'd actually had two punctures. So he took a chance, and fair. He had nothing to lose. Exactly. He had nothing to lose. And when you have nothing to lose, give it a go.
But ultimately, the rule is very clear. And if there had been Super Rally on the Sunday, then I'm with you, because, you know, the stewards would likely have excluded him. And then he had then cost Hyundai a chance. But then I would imagine, you know, I think we need to credit Hyundai, you know, Alain Panas and Andrea Adama with a significant amount of intelligence. I am sure they would have radioed to him and said, pull over. You know, it's not going to work. But equally, Oyten Martin would have gone back to them and said, we've got nothing to lose, like you say. But, you know, if it happens in Arctic
You'd like to think the team would have been on top of the potential tactics and strategy there.
Yeah.
But, they would,
the bottom
sure.
line is, you know, there's a massive advantage to going with only one spare wheel competitively than with two. You know, there's a time element there. You know, he potentially was going to gain 5 or 10 seconds by having one spare. So he took his chance. You know, he threw the dice and he took the chance and your spare, you know, it's not that.
But George, I don't agree with that, George. I don't agree with that. Under normal circumstances, if you're on Rally Catalunya in Spain, absolutely right. But what we saw in those stages in Monte Carlo was that, particularly those stages on the Saturday, was there were massive time differences, not to do with the weight of the car, but to do with your position on the road.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was a gamble worth taking. You know, he was the only one, more or less, who went out with one spare tyre, when really that wasn't going to be the deciding factor. It was how you coped with the conditions as they evolved on the road and with your road position. I think the question is not so much about whether he did the right thing, because, you know, that's absolutely debatable. But the question for me is, why was he allowed to go out with one spare tyre? You know, your number one driver, your best chance of winning.
That's my point.
Why was he allowed to go out with one spare tyre? Hey,
so the team wasn't so smart with their tactics and strategy.
No.
Which is kind of what Monte Carlo's all about. It's all about, you win the Monte Carlo rally to a greater extent than any other rally from the point of view of the team strategy and how that's applied. How you work your tyre information, your weather information, how you apply that to the drivers, how much confidence the drivers have got in your team and your engineers to believe what you're telling them, and are they on board with it? Obviously, that wasn't the case there, I guess, in some way.
I get all of that, and I understand that, but, you know, it was there was two stages in the loop, Cole. You know, it wasn't a three-stage loop, and if you were going to take a gamble, you know,
That wasn't the gamble, though. That wasn't the gamble, because the gamble was the conditions. Remember, they'd wrecked in entirely different conditions from the conditions they came across in the morning. They were super difficult conditions because it was that intermittent snow and ice. You know, as we saw with hindsight, the stage really did evolve the more cars that went through it. You know, the gamble wasn't, for me, that extra 20 kilos that you saved. The gamble was understanding the conditions, driving to maybe the pace notes you'd made in full snow, all those things. There were other gambles. That wasn't a gamble that was going to actually give you a massive payoff in that stage. Being brave, being ballsy, driving to your notes, that might have given you a big payoff. Extra little bit of weight saving? Nah, absolutely not. Not on that short loop.
You know, I'd still challenge you to go back and give me five drivers who've had successive punctures in those conditions on a Monte. I would still maintain that, you know, one spare across two stages.
I think retrospectively we can agree with Colin that it's right. But beforehand, David, you can also, you know, the chances of a puncture are maybe sitting down at 10 or 15%. That's pretty low, and you know, Ott Tanak's one of the guys that's probably better at normally managing all those things. And, you know, in a competitive situation when you were dealing with a narrower margin event like Finland, you'd say, nah, of course we're going to trust you, on you go, we'll back you 100% one spare tire.
And that's the point. You look at that scenario, you know, on that Saturday morning when they're going out, and Tanak would have been pushing like hell to go, you know, the car as lean as possible, wouldn't he?
Yeah, that's the nature of the job, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway, there we go.
So, end of the weekend.
Subject, I'm bored with that one.
I was going to say, end of the weekend, we saw Sebastian Ogier become the greatest ever Monte Carlo winner.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's still some people who say he's only won 7 Monte Carlos. In fact, I saw it in an official programme. I find it remarkable. You know, a Monte Carlo win is a Monte Carlo win, and the fact it wasn't part of the WRC in 2009. Is neither here nor there. He has won the Monte Carlo Rally 8 times.
And, Cole, just to jump in there, that makes me laugh. That really makes me laugh that somebody would question his 2009 win fine, it wasn't a round of the World Rally Championship, but it was the first time he'd ever competed on that event. I think that might just about balance it out.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And it astonished me. It astonished me when I was listening to a commentary and they said it's his seventh win on the Monte. And I thought, hang on a minute. You know, it's his eighth win on the Monte. You know, if you want to say those sorts of things, then say what is correct. It's his seventh WRC win on the Monte. Yeah. That is correct. Yeah. Yeah. But it's his eighth Monte Carlo win.
But you know, regardless, it was just quite majestic, wasn't it? You know, it was Sébastien Ogier at his absolute best.
Sublime best.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
And certainly, the emotion, David, the emotion. Oh. And I've seen a lot, as we all have, but George, you and I in particular have seen a lot of Ogier from his early days in the juniors, in the when he burst on the scene and nobody could quite decide how to pronounce his name. When he was in the little Citroen. Mm. And he's not a man for showing emotion other than when he's angry. And when he's angry, he shows a lot of emotion. But he doesn't show tearful emotion that often. And we saw that, didn't we? And David, you got to the bottom of it. And it was a wonderful story that you found out. It obviously meant a lot to him, but there were many reasons. One in particular, wasn't there, that it meant so much to him?
There was. But just before we get to that, what was your first shot back in Mexico 2008, Cole? How did you go for the surname?
Ogier.
I would have always said Ogier, but I think I know
Ogier.
Another Ogier, actually.
There was an Ogier for a while.
Yes,
I missed that one.
Yeah.
What do we all go for now? I'm an Ogier.
Ogier. I'm a more of an O rather than an
O. Ogier.
Ogier. That's the Ogier.
Ogier. What did I say? I said Ogier.
Is it Ogier though, or is it Ogier?
You said Ogier.
No,
David,
I think
you said Ogier.
I don't. Ogier. There's no e on the end, so I think Ogier. You kind of soften the final r, don't you? Ogier. Not Ogier. Speaking of which,
Scottish
David
up
Evans.
Here, we have to say it with an R. The R has to be rolled and said.
I have to say, I do love the little play on words that you did. I hope it's not a typo, because it's brilliant. On the dirtfish.com website, you talking about Monte Carlo, David Evans, and talking about the van show.
Yes.
It's spelt V-A-N.
N.
Yeah, you see, hot vans coming in. And I thought, that's exactly what a service park smells like. It does. It smells of brake dust and engines.
It does.
And not mulled wine.
Yes, of course, Lise. That was absolutely
well, except
a
except in Monte Carlo,
words.
Normally you'll get the smell of hot mulled wine around there somewhere.
But no, Cole, going back to your thinking about
observation.
You know, it did mean a huge amount to him, because, you know, he obviously, we all know, he lives in Forêt Saint-Julien, just outside. I love saying that. Forêt Saint-Julien. Do you think I say that
he doesn't
right?
live there, David.
No,
doesn't
shut
live
up.
There.
That was where he was born and brought up. He probably wasn't born there, but he was certainly brought up there. And if you drive through Forêt Saint-Julien on the rally, you know damn well that there was only one current WRC star coming from there. Have you been through there while it's been on? Have you seen the huge you'd call it a poster, but it's obviously not a poster, because it's made of like kind of tenty sort of, what do you call that material that's durable?
Tarpaulin.
Canvas.
It's like
canvas,
a collage.
Canvas. Whoever said canvas, go to the top of the class. It's a huge canvas that hangs, and it must be, I don't know, 15 meters high. It's massive, and it hangs on the side of somebody's house, and it's just really cool. If anybody's wondering where they can find that, that's in Forêt Saint-Julien every January. So he was brought up in the region, and obviously just before, well, October, November time last year, there were some terrible storms that ripped through the heart of that area. And we saw there was significant change to the itinerary for the rally, with the traditional Sunday stages in the Alt Maritime, the sort of Col de Tirreni around the Sospel area, they were all lost. And I think, Col, did we move west from there? I think we moved.
We did, yeah, a little bit westerly, a little bit away from Italy and not towards Italy, because that's where the main centre of that terrible storm was, as you say.
Yeah.
And
you know, in the end, Sébastien has auctioned some of his gloves and some race kit to raise some money for the families. And you know, people died in these storms, and people are still, you know, this is that age old thing, isn't it? You know, it was huge news during that week, and now we've all moved on. But you know, some of these people are still, of course, they're out of their homes. You know, they've got no homes now; they've been washed away, and they're living this nightmare in the middle of what is already a very difficult time for the world. Yeah. And he recognised that. And, you know, it just, for me, that speaks volumes about the bloke he is.
He's a thoroughly, thoroughly good person, Sebastian Ogier. And for many years he was, and he still is in some quarters, very, very badly misunderstood.
Yeah.
And even by people who do understand him, people who just don't like him represent him badly. And I just think it's so unfair. He is a thoroughly good person, but he is a magnificent sportsman. Go on. I was just going to say, he's got that attitude, which is, you know, that every single world champion in every discipline has, and that is the absolute desire to win. They are blinkered, they are focused, you know, and nothing else matters other than winning. And, you know, what do we expect? The guy is quite probably, and in my books he is, the greatest driver of all time. And, you know, occasionally you see a slightly abrasive side to him, but that's what they need. You know, these people are, you know, an elite
I think it's
minority.
It's very fair. It's fair to say, Cole, that he is Forêt Saint-Julien's finest, would you say?
He really is.
You're going to get fined if you keep saying that.
Do you think you're pronouncing that correctly, though, David?
So his next, he's going to be focusing his eyes on our next event, and we've got the Arctic Rally coming up next. Should we be going to the Arctic Rally?
I would like to have dinner with Sebastian Ogier, Lisa. That's what I would like to do. And I would like to talk about Arctic Rally, but more than that, I would like to talk about what I would talk about with Sebastian Ogier if I had dinner with him. I think he'd be fascinated in all aspects of motorsport discussion. I think the guy's probably just great company.
I would say so. And here's some news just in that we haven't actually written about this. But of our sort of modern age and modern generation, there is one driver who's now become a team principal who knows more about the sport and the current era and the current drivers and everybody. Of course, Jari-Matti Latvala. So I was chatting away to Jari-Matti the other day, and I was telling him about the piece that we did for Dirtfish about, is Sebastian Ogier now the greatest Monty driver ever? And we chatted about that, and then we sort of moved on a little bit about, you know, is he now the best we've ever seen? And I was really interested, and Jari-Matti said that actually now, he said, for so long you couldn't see past Loeb. He said, but now actually maybe he starts to think that Ogier is better than Loeb, which is quite a revelation for a guy who ultimately Latvala's career spanned completely the same time as Loeb and Ogier, didn't it?
Yeah,
but you've got to listen to him. He's driven against them.
Yeah,
both. He's driven with Ogier, obviously, but he's driven against them both. And you know, Latvala is supremely well placed, as you say, David, because he knows the current crop. But you know, there's no one that knows the history, that studies the history of rallying more than Jari-Matti Latvala, and for him to say that, it's interesting, and it gives massive credence to the argument that he's the best there's ever been, and I believe that entirely. I think a man that's won Monty 8 times in 5 different cars, a man that's won championships in, what is it, 3 different cars, you know, Loeb is brilliant. Loeb is a genius. But you put the two next to each other, and what Loeb has is more wins, more world titles and more individual wins. But what Ogier's got is more diversity. And to win in the diverse range of cars and the circumstances that he's won
under, I am going to move us on because I've got an eye on the clock here. And despite the fact that George wants to go and have a dinner party.
Give him his time, Lise. Give him his time. He's got something really important to say.
No, he did sound quite sad there, didn't he?
Colin, you're absolutely right. Just very, very briefly.
It wasn't you, was it? I thought it was David Evans.
Both those Sebs are just unbelievably fantastic. And they set a standard which will be very, very hard for someone to follow, but somebody will follow it.
Right,
and,
George, you know, we'll, I've got one question for you both.
That's it.
One question for you, for all three of you, actually. Who drove, whose era, in the middle of winning lots of championships and rallies, who faced the most difficult competition?
I felt that Sebastian Loeb was in a class of his own because he only ever seemed to be driving at 90%. And if anybody pushed him, he went up a gear, if that was at all possible, being in top gear. So I can't say, like, I'm going to have to probably go for Ogier then because he's had such diverse challenges. I'm using your word there, Colin.
That's all right. You're more than welcome. I mean, listen, Ogier, when he won with M Sport in that first year, there were 8 different drivers won rounds of the championship. Mm-hmm. That's proper competition. proper competition.
When did Sebastian Loeb do that?
He didn't.
Probably 2000 and...
He didn't.
He didn't. He didn't ever do it.
That many drivers, no.
Not when that many won. Yeah, because for a lot of the time that Loeb was driving, Gronholm. Remember, it was just Citroën and M-Sport. It was Gronholm and Loeb. It was Hirvonen and Loeb.
Yeah.
And we had Subaru as you know, a bit part
a little bit of Subaru, but more you had Marcus Gronholm was Loeb's biggest rival. I think.
Well, Hirvonen.
And in fairness, you know, Solberg as well.
Hirvonen never challenged in the same way that
Marcus
Gronholm did. I don't think that would be fair to either of them.
No, you're right.
That.
He got very close 1 year.
He did.
But only ever across the spread of a full season. Petter Solberg is the only man who ever beat Sebastian Loeb across a full season that everybody competed in. Because before 2003, in 2002, obviously Loeb was only doing a part program. And then his first full year was in 2003 when Petter won. And then Petter was the only... He pushed in pretty hard in 2004 as well, didn't he, George? Were you there?
Yeah, I'd actually moved on to the working full time with Subaru in Japan at that point, but I was obviously still very much involved on a day to day basis and on all the events, just looking after a different aspect. And I think the car had started to disagree with Petter to a great extent. And then, you know, latterly, as that went on, there was that program. You know, they advertised, they did their dirty washing in public, didn't they? Really, when there was. They did that fly in the wall documentary for the year when the car had lots of problems. Certainly, I mean, the nicest thing you can say about it is Petter didn't gel with the car. I'm sure if you speak to Petter, you'll get maybe harsher words on it.
Having said that, that was the 04 car, Cole, that we did that thing with. And was that just before Christmas? Or was that this year?
No. No, David, it was a couple of weeks ago.
Crikey. Yes. This year really is rattling along, isn't it? But we did a, you should look out for this video, a fascinating insight into ProDrive rebuilding Petter's 2004 Japan car. And we were talking to Andy Brown and people at ProDrive there. And, of course, he won Japan, then he won GB, and then he won Sardinia. So, you know, a hat-trick of events winning in 2004. So Petter was still there. I think he finished second in 2004 to Sebastian.
It was probably five, six and seven that became more problematic for him.
But if you remember, boys, 2004 was the year that Petter was going to win every rally. That was what he said at the start of the year.
No, he said he was going to win 10, didn't he? He said he thought he could win 10.
Yeah. It just all went the wrong way. But anyway... So, David, what was the answer to your question then? You know, what do we take out of it?
I don't know. I mean, the fact is that, you know, ultimately, if you kind of praise that question, you know, who had the easier time? Who had less competition? And ultimately, it looks like we're going to go with Sebastian Loeb.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
That's worth a poll, perhaps. At Dirtfish Rally, if you've got any thoughts on that.
But... I still wouldn't compare the two drivers. I think they're both equally just fantastic. They're equal all-time greats. In the same way you almost can't measure previous champions. You know, do you want to measure Hannu Mikkola's dominance? He was as dominant as...
Another debate, boys and girls.
But you know the whole point is, I think a great driver is a great driver. Bjørn Waldegard, yes. Hannu Mikkola.
Yeah, so ultimately, Walter does that mean Roll. Colin McRae's four times worse than Tommy Mäkinen? I think not.
Categorically not, but certainly at four times different, a different approach to Tommy Mäkinen, you might say. You know, there was just, you know, Colin came at it, he was going to win every stage on his way to winning an event, and he would win every event on his way to winning a championship. And if that didn't go to plan, there was no backstop. Colin was everything up front, and Tommy wasn't terribly dissimilar, but
I was just
going to
say
fractionally more measured in by way of catching four championships. Hey, it might have just been the luck of the draw.
I do remember talking to Colin once about the two of them. Might have been in 2003, and Colin said, "I'll not see either of us finishing second very often."
What did he say, David? What did he say?
You're going to do the accent.
What language is that you were speaking in? What did he say?
It was definitely racist anyway, Colin. You're quite right to get your hackles up, you miserable sort.
Stereotypical, George.
Exactly.
I don't think that's illegal yet, Colin, either morally or legally. You're okay.
I thought it was like he was in the room.
But you know, that's, I mean, that was, and again, I wouldn't, if you told me who's the best, Tommy or Colin, I wouldn't want to measure between the two. The statistics can give you a measurement if you want. They were both absolutely brilliant. God save us. Yeah. I mean, entertainment value alone, Colin would win. In championship results, Tommy wins. You know?
What would we give? What would the World Championship give for another Colin McRae right now? You know, if we move things on to our next discussion, which was, you know, Motorsport UK and this announcement by their chief executive? You know, and it all seems doom and gloom in terms of British rallying. But what would we give?
Just explain that as well.
Yeah, I'll explain it in a second. But if, you know, for another Colin McRae, we're crying out for someone. You know, it's a strange thing. You know, talk about...
Cole, I've got to stop you there because categorically, the World Rally Championship cannot afford another Colin McRae. It can't. You know,
that was going to be my point, 100%.
Sorry, George.
Yeah, all right. No,
you're quite right. I'm happy you've made it. Yeah.
You know, you look at the way that Colin progressed through the sort of 91, 92, 93, you know, even up to, you know, 96, the year after his championship. You know, he was bending metal on a regular basis. And that approach now, simply, it would not be tolerated and it could not be afforded. And, you know...
I get that.
We're not going to get one.
Would he get hired today? If Colin McRae turned up, would
absolutely.
He get a job?
So if we had a precocious talent with that sort of all or nothing approach that, you know, that just said the right things, did the right things, was a little bit of a bad boy, is there no room for that anymore?
Yeah, there's plenty of room for that.
Because you got Gigi Galli, there's one, Chris Meek, there's another one. You know, there's not room for them, sadly.
No, I disagree with that, George. I think there is room for them, but I think that everybody's just almost too afraid to be that. And actually, Lise, you're dead right, because McRae would be employed because Oit Tanak was employed. You know, he tested Malcolm Wilson's patience tremendously, got sacked twice, but still, you know, he came back stronger and delivered ultimately in the same way that Colin did.
I see something about Oliver Solberg saying that he nearly got the shove because he was driving too fast?
Oliver?
Did I read that somewhere? Yeah, recently. Maybe not. Let me just ignore that. I'll take that out.
That's all right for you to do that, Lise.
So, Colin, we're going to move on to the point you wanted to talk about, Motorsport UK. Can you explain what has got your gander up?
Well, you know, we all know that right now, certainly Rally GB is off the WRC calendar for this year and for, who knows for how long, but certainly for this year. And Hugh Chambers, who is the chief executive?
Yep, CEO.
CEO of Motorsport UK, has written a rather extensive piece, which you can read on dirtfish.com. What is it? What is the piece? Is it an explanation or is it an excuse? I struggle to work out what it is because, it just confuses me totally. You know, it's criminal that we have lost Rally GB in this country. And what is more criminal? And this is unfair because I actually like the three guys involved, but... You know, when David Richards took over at Motorsport UK, I thought, this is great. Because remember, Motorsport UK looks after all motorsport, not just rallying. And the guy who'd been in charge before David Richards, he had a particular interest in, was it touring cars, David? I think it was, wasn't it, Alan Gow?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean that he neglected rallying Alan Gow, but, you know, but clearly his focus was in one particular area. David Richards takes over and you think, well, this can only be good for rallying. He appoints Hugh Chambers, a man who was central during the success days of the Subaru World Rally Team. You think, ooh, two of the top guys. They then bring in my namesake, Colin Clark. And there's three of them, and it's the perfect triumvirate of rallying. You know, these three guys at the top of motorsport in the UK are all dye-in-the-wool rally men. Cut their teeth in rallying, you know, grew up with rallying. They are absolutely the way forward. That was 3 years ago. Where are we now? Where are we now? You know, we're in a situation with the British Rally Championship... it has big question marks over it. But more than that, we've lost Rally GB. We've lost, you know,
Colin.
We have, David. George, we've lost it.
They've given it away. We've not lost it. They gave it away.
They've given it away. This
is
the point I was coming to.
Shocking.
This is the, you know, for me, the article gives an absolute list of reasons why. As I say, read them as you want, reasons or excuses. But they had a choice at the end of the day. They could have invested in Rally GB and kept it within these shores. They could have, and it may have been a one-year, a two-year investment. It does mean spending money. And clearly, no one was prepared to spend money. And worse than that, they're now talking about, you know, the only way we can do this is on closed roads because of the cost. Because of the costs involved, the only way we can do this is on closed roads. They're more or less saying the days of rallying in the forests of North Wales, of Mid Wales, of South Wales, of Kielder, of the Scottish borders, of the Scottish Highlands, that is over with. That is done. That is not something that we can contemplate in the future because of cost. It there makes me a little bit angry, you know, because it's. I understand that we do have to change, that we do have to evolve.
Yeah, but, you know, my argument with this, Colin, and I can see where Hugh Chambers is coming from, because the cost of running a forest round is considerably higher than running a closed road event. But I think I'm exactly like you that, you know, for me, Britain's Round of the World Rally Championship, call it the RAC Rally, call it Rally GB, should always, absolutely always be in the forest. You know, you'd never see a tarmac Thousand Lakes or Rally Finland. You just wouldn't. But there are reasons for it. I think, you know, before we go any further, we do need to say that Britain does still have a very good chance of having a WRC round next year with Rally Northern Ireland. Thanks to
don't believe that. Well, I don't believe it, David. Then I think the guys in Ireland will do a magnificent job. And I think if they can come up with rather a lot of money, maybe it'll happen. But once you're off that calendar, once you're into the pool of countries who effectively are involved in an auction, you know, that's the place. Right. Let's see who bids the most.
Well, that's
once
it.
We get into that situation, we're stuffed. You know, because what we do know is that Bobby Willis and his fine bunch of boys and girls in Ireland will raise a budget. But what we do know is that Motorsport UK will not top that up. They won't top that up. They won't say, OK, we need an extra £2 million. To pay the fee to get onto this calendar. It won't happen.
I was just going to play devil's advocate there and say, you know, would that be a good use as a license fee payer myself? Because I did buy a license last year, not this year yet. Would I be happy with my money being invested in Rally GB? I'm not sure. But then I actually thought, yes, I would. Because the potential trickle-down effect of having a WRC round, surely, you know, in terms of safety crews, marshals, timing, just people understanding best practice from WRC coming into your country every year, it's got to be worth it. You know, but Motorsport UK would argue that they have already invested in Rally GB. You know, the investment from Cardiff has been trailing off to just over £1 million in 2019. We know that they get 700,000 from spectator revenue. It's not enough. You know, they would have to top that up. So they have invested in it. And what frustrates me a bit is, you know, you talk to the FIA and to Yves Maton, and they understand the heritage, the necessity to keep these iconic rounds in the championship. But that's balanced by the commercial necessity that's brought to the table by the WRC promoter that says, look, you know, we have to make the championship fly, and everybody has to pay their way. And unfortunately, you know, whatever GB Hugh Chambers was talking about, less than 2 million, it's not going to be enough to get us a round of the World Rally Championship. It's just not. You know, when countries like Turkey are spending 3 or 4 million, whatever, you know, every year for 3 years, even more than that, I think it was actually, in Croatia are coming in with a big budget. You know, as much as the FIA wants its history and its heritage, the WRC promoter is going to come back with, you know, sorry, boys, we've got to balance that with the fact that we've got to do the sums here.
Go back to one of my old arguments, David. Just change the format. Start the rally on a Sunday in GB. That'll sort the job out.
Or actually, George, fundamentally, what we need to do here is stop. You know, this was DR's absolute argument year after year after year about the championship, the number of rounds going up. What we need to do here is not look at the cost, but look at the value derived from the investment.
That's exactly right.
You know,
exactly.
because exactly right. David Richards quite rightly said, you know, I remember having this debate with him in back in 04, 05, when we were talking about bringing a new round of the championship. And I argued that the manufacturers were saying, you know, we've got 12 rounds, we cannot afford 13 rounds. So DR quite rightly said to me, okay, so we've got Skoda in the championship. Now you tell me that 13th round is going to be in the Czech Republic. then suddenly you'll find that Škoda does have the money. That's because they can leverage the value from a home round of the World Championship. Mm. It's not about the cost. It is about what we can make from it. And right now, the argument is within Britain, there is not the value in a WRC round. So therefore, we have to find out why. And, you know, David and Hugh both have banged on and on about the fact that 20 years ago, McRae and Burns were on the front and the back pages. How do we get back there? You know, that if we can solve that, then we will forever have a round of the World Championship here.
Mm. I think there are other ways. I think if that's what we're relying on, then you know, we can just kiss goodbye to it. Your Elvin, we all keep our fingers
British,
crossed.
Guys. This is all too British. Who cares? Yeah. It's a great rally. I'd love to see it back in the forests. Doesn't sound like it's going to happen because the people in charge will decide. We can debate it as much as we want. I would say start on a Sunday, run all your classics Mickey Mouse Sunday stages. You'll get your revenue right back up there. You get your forest, you'll get your diehards going in on Monday and Tuesday into the forests. Perfect. Great rally.
Yeah,
I think it's worth opening it up, though, because
it will be the issue, George, that, you know, that's not going to work for a TV format, is it? You know,
no, they probably want, not. No.
They, you know, all live will want people. But I guess, you know,
David, I watch and listen to more of the rally on a Thursday and a Friday than I do on a Saturday and a Sunday.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
To be honest, if it was rally radio, I'd be set with it listening on my phone in my pocket whilst I'm dodging away in the garage doing some bits and pieces or whatever I'm doing. But sitting and watching videos, I watch the highlights in the evening. And you know, occasionally I can catch the odd stage on a Saturday. I did a little bit more this year because the weather was horrible outside, etc. But
fundamentally, I think, you know, Cole, you're right. You know, your point that we need to tackle, you know, the grassroots in Britain, because we need to build, you know, you look back to when those great days of the early 90s, the early 90s specifically, when McRae won the British Championship in 91, 92, and Richard in 93, they were pretty poor years for the British Championship. You know, there was the Pro Drive team and there was Malcolm, you know, with Stephen Finlay and an occasional guest driver in a Michelin pilot car, Ari Vatanen, or these kind of people. There was no depth. You know, there was probably four or five potential winners at every round for, you know, and take that back to 89, you know, when David Llewellyn was in that GT4, the one and only four-wheel drive car in 89, 90. You know, for 5 or 6 years, British Championship was shocking, but it kept going because it had quite a good support in the classes and everybody. And just, I think there were less events going on at that time, and everybody just seemed to just, you know, March was always Vauxhall Rally of Wales. The following month was always the Pirelli. Then it was the Ulster. And
I have to say that George has got a point. We have gone very British here, but I would like to open this out. If anyone's listening and has an opinion about whether it should go or whether it should go to new grounds is perhaps a good conversation to have. Get in touch with us at Dirtfish Rally on Twitter, because there are people out there listening to this who are thinking, I want to go and watch rallying in my country and it's not there at the moment, and I don't want to travel to see it on a traditional stage. So I want to hear those arguments as well. So if you've got any of those points, get in touch with us at Dirtfish Rally.
Just to come back to that point, though, Lise, because I kind of lost myself a little bit in that
you
argument.
You did, didn't you? You went all nostalgic.
I did miss the eye talking about Rally of Wales and Stephen Finlay. But the point is, the British Championship was pretty rubbish then. And it's, you know, it's by no means is it pretty rubbish now, because we've actually got a stronger and a healthier front of the field, I would suggest. Certainly a more accessible front of the field with R5 cars than we had with proper Group A cars back in the day.
You're still talking four or five drivers maximum, though, David. Four drivers maybe. And no depth in terms of, they are British drivers, almost exclusively these days. You know, the British Championship was at its best, clearly, when it was attracting drivers from all over the world.
Formula 2, actually, not when it was attracting drivers from all over the world, when it was supported by British importers.
That's true. That is very true. When we had manufacturer interest supporting British drivers in the British Championship. But, you know, you look at, you know, at least you're talking about opening it up to a wider audience and where it works. You know, I've done a wee bit of work in New Zealand with the New Zealand Championship. And things are healthy there. Things are healthy. It's, you know, in New Zealand, logistics of competing are very, very difficult. You know, you're covering vast areas over two different islands. But they regularly have you know, full entry lists, an amazing diversity of machinery. You know, they've got more women participating in the New Zealand Championship than just about any other championship in the world. I think when I did Otago last year, 30%, 35% of the entry list were women. And the atmosphere around that championship is fantastic. The one thing that they don't have is over-regulation. You know, they're not talking about homologated cars, not in the main anyway. And people, you know, it takes rallying back to what rallying should be. It's a fun participation sport the whole family can take part in. You can do it at a reasonable cost. You're never going to get away from the fact that motorsport is costly. It always will be. But as long as, you know, family A and family B think, yeah, we can pool our funds and we can run this car at the weekend. Dad drives, mum co-drives, the kids are working in the service area. And that is a very, very common occurrence out there. Mm. You know, you build it from the bottom. You build it from the bottom. You get people involved. You build the right atmosphere. You make it inclusive. You get rid of all the bickering and the bitchiness and the nonsense that pervades rallying in certain circumstances, in certain circles around the world.
Like in Britain. Like
in Britain, George, exactly.
Could I just bang back to British Championship very quickly, Colin? Hold that thought. I changed my mind. Actually, probably the British Championship was at its best, like you say, when we had the likes of Vatten and Mikkola in the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay, that's unbelievable then, guys. I cut my teeth spectating back then. You cannot believe how good it was.
Yeah, sorry.
You cannot
I think there are lessons to be learned from championships around the world. If we say it starts at the bottom, it starts with grassroots, then it's not just a regulatory change. It's a whole cultural, institutional change. We need to change, you know, really the atmosphere around rallying, I think, at the grassroots. And if we can do that, then we have hope and we can build something. And we can say, yeah, let's forget Rally GB for 4 or 5 years. Let's invest the money in grassroots rallying. Let's build it. What I will not tolerate is losing GB and seeing nothing happening at the grassroots level. And that's what scares me. That's what scares me. We've had 3 years of the current management team to deal with a situation which was always on the horizon. It was always going to happen. It was, you know, the Welsh government's contract was always going to run out. It was always going to be less each year. They knew what was going to happen. Then all of a sudden, oh my God, this has happened. You know, okay, if it has to be, it has to be. But let's see something positive and concrete being put in place to build for the future. Otherwise, we can forget it.
Instead of that very disingenuous hand-wringing that goes on, what can we do? We're not making enough money, and, well, it's not what the people want. We've got to do this, and it's all just very, false.
George, it's very predictable. It's very predictable, George, sadly.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, well, I think we're going to stop there before we start getting personal.
Oh, yes.
I'm stopping it before we get personal.
Yeah, quite right.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of wrap things up. We didn't get to the Arctic Rally, but we will perhaps do a preview of the Arctic Rally, which is the next event on the WRC calendar.
Weeks until then.
So we've got plenty of time to prepare
for
that. Yeah.
Very cold. Yeah, it's minus 30. I mean,
they've got to take survival kits with them.
Yay. You cannot believe. I did a Swedish rally once when it got to minus 35, minus 38, and it was awful. It was absolutely. I broke down. I got hypothermia.
I've got children to pick up from school.
Crack on.
Well done,
much
boys.
Much more important than rally. No, nothing's more important than rally. We know that.
Well done, boys. Nice to speak to you.
Thank
Catch you soon.
Lisa. It was lots of fun.
Thanks, Lisa. David, thanks for that call.